The Jazz Scene Podcast gives an in-depth look at the lives and stories of the musicians performing in Columbus and beyond. Our host, Zach Comston, is joined by the amazing Broadway performer, Mamie Paris. Mamie spent the week with the Jazz Arts Group both in schools and on stage with your Columbus Jazz Orchestra for Home for the Holidays.
Mamie Paris, welcome to the Jazz Scene Podcast with the Jazz Arts Group.
Gosh, it's great to be here.
We are so thrilled to have you, and I'm excited about this one and this week that we're in, Home for the Holidays with the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, partly because the opening of our season was very instrumental music heavy, and it was great. We had two shows, small group shows at the Lincoln Theater that featured instrumentalists, and then our first show in October was all heavily instrumental, focused on a trumpeter named Tony Glousey. And now you are our first vocalist of the season.
Ooh.
And it's nice in many ways because it's holiday season, like no better time.
Yeah.
You know, and we're bringing the Broadway and jazz, you know, genres together and styles together. I want to, in this conversation, get to a bunch of things, but I just want to start maybe with now and your life right now. So you came directly from New York, but you've been busy in recent months, and you're about to continue to be busy.
Yeah.
As an actress and singer, tell us sort of how you're piecing everything together right now in your life that adds up to everything that you're up to.
It's interesting. You know, it is kind of a balancing act. I think especially after the big pandemic that we all went through and lockdown, we all kind of found new roads for a career and life. And I'm no different in that sense that before that, I had really developed this wonderful theatrical career, which I love and I appreciate and I'm so grateful for, which included a lot of Broadway and developing new works, and I toured for a bit and that kind of thing. And during lockdown, I really said, you know, I want to reevaluate what it is I want to be doing and what I'm capable of doing to have more autonomy in my career. So much of being in the Broadway world and that kind of thing, you know, you have some control over it, but it really is about like getting the call, getting the audition, or being a part of the development so that you go with a piece. And a lot of times all that is out of your control. Mm. So it's been wonderful to develop this other part of my career. I had already started doing concerts with symphony orchestras, doing my own show here and there pre-pandemic. And ever since then, I've really picked those kinds of things up. I love singing with an orchestra. I love being here with the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. After this, I'll be in Milwaukee with the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra, in Baltimore with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. In January, I'll be in Phoenix. Mm. I love these concerts. It gives me an opportunity to sing things I don't always get to sing. It gives me an opportunity to perform with just absolutely the highest level of musicians out there, which is such a gift. And it allows me more freedom in my career and more time to do some of the things I love. I started narrating and producing audiobooks. Mm. I have a home studio that I do that in. It's something I really, really enjoy and I've been able to supplement my career with. And then exploring kind of the things that I loved when I first came up. Like I, you know, came up in Kansas City, Missouri. I went to a performing arts school there. I started singing jazz when I was a teenager. It's been great to revisit that aspect of my life.
Right.
It's been great to revisit when I first started in theater and my love was classical theater, and I've been able to kind of revisit those elements of my life and my career that I think had kind of gone on the back burner while I was busy fielding these Broadway phone calls in the years before the pandemic. So that's kind of where I am.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I want to get into that sort of that last piece, which is your craft, because I see sort of two worlds, you know, you as a singer and your voice, and then the pursuit of musical theater. Before we get into that, I just have to ask, you know, some of your work when you leave here will be with Byron Stripling.
Yes.
I had a couple other
locations.
Whom
I adore.
Tell us about that relationship. How long have you known him? How did that sort of start to come together?
You know, I believe that Byron and I first worked together, and I hope I'm not wrong about this. I believe it was at the Holiday Pops concert for the Fort Worth Symphony Orchestra about 2 years ago, right? It was one of the earlier concerts coming out of lockdown.
Sure.
Was with Byron there, and we weren't there a long time together, but we hit it off immediately. First of all, He's just a gem. He's so likable mm-hmm. on stage. Everyone falls in love with Byron. So by the time I walk out as the guest vocalist, everybody's in a good mood.
Yeah, they're warmed up.
Yeah, yeah. It's exciting. It's like having the best warm-up act ever in Byron Stripling. And he's just so fun to play with on stage. He's such a professional. So we had a great time doing that. We both reported back to the powers that be that we'd love to do more of that. And he's got more control in that space than I do.
Sure.
So luckily, we were able to work together again last year in St. Louis. And we spent a lot more time together, a much longer amount of time there in St. Louis with the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra, which was absolutely wonderful. They have a beautiful hall there that's kind of a bigger version almost of the Southern Theater here, this
right.
beautiful old acoustic hall called the Powell Hall or Powell Hall,
yeah.
Which was lovely. And we, again, agreed. We said, we've got to do this more often. And, you know, Byron has always, from day one, talked about his home base in Columbus and the Columbus
right.
Jazz Orchestra. And he said, I got to get you out to Columbus. And so finally we made it happen, and I'm so glad we have. He's a blast.
I think about Byron, you know, I've known him for a long time now. And as the leader of the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, you know, he keeps his identity, you know, really solid. Trumpet, band leader. It's like he's so secure in that identity. But one of the things that I think, like, you know, history will show is his ability to conceive of and be a part of developing gigs, shows.
Absolutely.
And, you know, he's quiet about that because I think he just would prefer to have the horn in his mouth and be in play. But I think having had the fortune of playing a couple of those, Rochester and Pittsburgh with him, I've started to become struck by his sense for what will work in a show, especially mm-hmm. with symphony, what themes will work. And I think it's really a gift, and maybe something arguably that's you see less and less of, that individual that can just put different themes together and continually captivate audiences.
Absolutely. And I think that's one of the great gifts of having the kind of experience he has.
Right.
You know, he's been playing with different orchestras for years. He has such a wealth of knowledge and a wealth of experience to draw from that for him, I think it's second nature.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it occurs to him that this is a real talent to be able to put something like this together. The instinct and the intuition to know what's going to work is really, really impressive.
Yeah, I agree. And I want to hear more about the show in a few minutes. But first, let's go kind of back to the beginning. Did you grow up in Kansas City? Because I understand you were born in Texas.
I was born in Texas. We lived in the Dallas-Fort Worth area until I was about 9. We moved around a little bit. My mom was airline and landed eventually when I was about 11 in Kansas City, Missouri. So I went to 1 year of middle school at the Middle School for the Arts in Kansas City. And then my high school, I went to the Paseo Academy for the Fine and Performing Arts in Kansas City, Missouri. Kansas City was really, those were the formative years, I would say, because those are your teenage years. And then when I was 17, I moved to New York. I went to school there at the American Musical and Dramatic Academy. Got a great education, and then just kind of got out and started working. And I didn't really come from money, so I just kind of had to take all the jobs. Any job I could get, I took.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, you know, it sometimes was frustrating because I could see my friends who, you know, had a backup or had parents that were paying their rent who could afford to kind of wait for the thing they really wanted. So at the time, I remember sometimes being a little envious of that, but honestly, in hindsight, I got so much wonderful experience and learned so much and became a better performer because I had to take every job.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so I've done a little bit of everything. It's great.
In those earliest years, you know, it seems like you were on a path toward, you know, going to schools that would develop your craft. But in the earliest years, where did the musical influence come from? Family, environment?
Yeah, you know, I think that's a good question. My family always sang. Always musical. My parents were not in the arts, but my mom had just absolutely one of the most beautiful voices. I always say she sounded like Karen Carpenter, and I stand by it.
Mm-hmm.
She just sang around the house all the time. It became a joke with our extended family. I remember my aunts, one year we were all at my mama's house in Louisiana for Christmas, and somebody said, because my mom just sings and hums all the time, and they said, okay, when she comes back in, somebody hums something, and let's see how long it takes her to pick it up.
Yeah.
And they chose Susie Snowflake. I don't know if you know that song.
Here
comes Susie Snowflake, dressed in a long white gown.
Okay.
It's this cute little Christmas song. And she came in to get something, and one of my aunts, and it took about 2 seconds. My mother was in the kitchen just washing the dishes, dressed in a long white gown, tap, tap, tapping at your window pane. So music was just kind of always around. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know much beyond that. I listened to pop music. That was, you know, that was my exposure, really. Yep. I wanted to be Whitney Houston. I loved...
Who didn't?
I mean, yeah. And that was the music, that was my favorite, you know, R&B and pop and that kind of thing. And then when I landed in Kansas City and happened to get into this school for the arts, which I wanted to go to if I could because mm-hmm. I wanted to sing,
right.
I got in at the very last minute, couldn't choose any classes. And so they just assigned classes, and as luck would have it, I didn't have a music class, but I had a theater class and I had a dance class. And that kind of changed my whole perspective. Eventually, I did wind up in a choir, and because it was a performing arts, a publicly funded performing arts school, at the time they were able to give, if you were a music minor or a music major or something, you received private voice lessons.
Oh, great.
So from the time I was like 12, 13, I had private voice lessons. And what a gift.
Yep.
Not something I ever would have had available to me had it not been for this public school.
Right.
So that's kind of how I landed there. And from then on, you know, my world really opened up. I discovered acting. I discovered a lot more about music, a lot more favorites. I discovered jazz. It was a wonderful experience.
In those early years, as you were introduced to musical theater and acting, you know, I imagine I'm a drummer, and so, you know, during those sort of formative years, you're doing everything.
Yeah.
You're playing in a combo, and you're in the, you know, concert band maybe, were you sort of in a lot of different types of singing environments, or did you find yourself focusing early on more toward the acting, or were you just using your voice in multiple sort of ways?
I think I was really kind of like you. I was using it in a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
I was very fortunate to be in this kind of school that didn't just offer like a concert choir.
Right.
You know, we had a lot of options available to us both during school hours and extracurricular wise. So I did fall in love with acting. So I went headfirst into acting right away, but I never stopped singing. So I remember being a member of like the concert choir, and we were very ambitious because we were the performing arts school.
Sure.
So we would do like Carmina Burana, like
right.
crazy things.
Mm-hmm.
We had a very, very ambitious choir director. But then we also had the Renaissance choir that I was a part of, because I just loved complex harmonies and I just wanted to sing interesting stuff. And then we had, of course, like a wonderful jazz orchestra, smaller jazz bands that I would be able to sing with. We also had a jazz ensemble group that was kind of selective called Jazz Wave, the Jazz Wave. So while other schools had like show choirs, we had Jazz Wave. And we took it very seriously. Mm-hmm. We had wonderful guest artists and teachers come in, and we had a combo that played with us. And so that became a big part of it. So I really did get to try a lot of things. Meanwhile, I was taking voice lessons where I was singing classically.
Right.
So I really got to try a lot of things and learn what I did well and what I enjoyed most, and I kind of followed those paths, I guess.
And that was something that came to mind is, so in that really formative, rich environment, what did setting goals look like for you? What early goals materialized that set you on a path? Obviously, you ended up in New York, you ended up on Broadway, you ended up on so many shows, both touring and otherwise. Were there early goals that materialized that you're like, I'm going to do that?
You know, I think... like a lot of people, I probably romanticized a life that maybe I wanted. I loved the idea of living in New York. I loved the idea of being surrounded. I think, again, coming from a school that had musicians, that had visual artists, sculptors and painters, that had writers, I was always surrounded by these artistic types that, you know, you imagine being surrounded by when you move to New York and live in the village. And mm-hmm. so I very much wanted to stay in that world.
Yeah.
And my ultimate goal, I think, even at that young age, I really wanted to make a living doing what I loved.
Yeah.
You know, and whether that wound up being in a musical sense, in a theatrical sense, if I was dancing for my supper, I wanted to do this for a living. It never, at that point in time, it was never a hobby. And I knew that could change, and I still know in my life that could change. Yep. You know, that maybe one day I'll want to go in another direction, and it will become just a very passionate hobby. But I knew pretty early on, you know, I had, I would say, somewhat unconventional parents, not crazy unconventional, but like my mom was a flight attendant. Mm-hmm. And I remember her saying to me at one point, she said, you know, I was a secretary and I worked in an office, and she's like, I think when it comes down to it, I'm just not a 9-to-5 person.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, like, I think I have that bug. I want something else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's such a gift. And I thought similarly to that, as you described your early sort of concept on success in those early years, there's the virtue of having to work a lot, mm-hmm. you know, right there, which is you were more concerned about sort of the full spread of everything you were doing. It wasn't like, so there's the payoff already of having to work a lot is like, well, I'm going to work a lot.
Yeah.
It kind of, you know, onboards that into your DNA of like, well,
I think it's
this
made
is my
me,
career.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it's made me more varied in my career and a better singer, a better actor, a better person. And I think it's given me wonderful memories and stories in a way that if I had really zeroed in and targeted on one specific goal from the beginning of my career, I would have missed out on these other things. Yeah. You know, I've performed on cruise ships. I toured with a country singer. Mm. I've done like a little bit of everything. You know, when there weren't jobs available here, I stage managed or, you know, so you got to experience a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And I'm happy that I got to experience all those things.
Was there somebody that, you know, when I was in Pittsburgh with Byron last month, my drum teacher is from that area, my original high school drum teacher.
Oh, great.
And I was able to sit down with him to lunch. And which, you know, I'm in my mid-30s now, and I'm doing a lot of different things, and life is busy with kids and so forth. But to take that time, he was just beaming, and I was so happy to be with him. He's in his 70s now. He's lost his wife. We went out to my car, and I had a drum to show him, an old drum from the 30s that I bought. And at the end, he gives me a hug and he goes, I'm just so damn proud of you. And I was like, oh. And I'm not super emotional, but that one just hit me. And I just said, Rick, I couldn't have done it without you. And he said, well, that means a lot. Is there someone that, or some people, that either in that time or as you started your professional career, that you look back and go, dang, I couldn't have done it without that person or people?
You know, the list is so long.
Yeah.
With the people who influence you in the right ways,
which
is wonderful, because I think so much of the time the people who influence us in the wrong ways or who leave an impression that's not a great impression are the ones who stick with us, because that's just, we're human,
mm-hmm.
and you know, our feelings get hurt or we're told something, it's that stays with you. I think it's so important to go back and recognize the moments that helped shape you in the best way,
mm-hmm.
and there are a lot of them. I will say I have this wonderful relationship now. My friend Ron, who I first met as a 12-year-old in eighth grade, my first year at the Performing Arts School, the Middle School for the Performing Arts,
mm-hmm.
when I didn't get to select my classes and they threw me into classes, I was in a class called, I believe it was Intro to Theater.
Okay.
And my teacher was Mr. Meyer, Ron Meyer. And it was his first year teaching. He was probably 23. And I found him so lovely and inspiring, and everything he said hit home with me and made me go, oh, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. I get it. His passion for theater, his passion for the arts were so infectious, you know, that it really stuck with me. And as luck would have it, I wound up kind of getting moved from his class once I developed a little more skill, and they've discovered that I really was interested in it. I moved to kind of a more advanced class with a different teacher. But he left such an impression on me. And years later, he was teaching towards the end of his teaching career at another high school, and we had connected at some point over, you know, Instagram or Facebook or something. And I sometimes go to schools and teach classes and do master classes. And he asked me to come to his school. So for several years in a row, I went to the school where he taught and conducted these master classes and got to work with him again, which was so fascinating. And when we talked, we spoke, and it was kind of the same thing. He said, I'm just really so proud. And he was at a place in his life where he was looking at retirement. He actually retired during the pandemic.
Okay.
And he said, I miss performing. I've missed performing. I left that side of me behind once I really started teaching. And he started auditioning for theaters in the area again. And now that he's retired, let me tell you, he works constantly. He's always in a play. He's always in a musical. And it's so interesting to see how the tables have turned. Now I'm the one that comes to him and says, I am so proud of you. And he's so sweet that, you know, I deserve no credit for it. But he says me coming in and speaking to his students and talking about, you know, trying all these things. And it's never too late. You can step away and you can come back.
Right.
Inspired him to go back to performing. And so we both, I think it's just fascinating that over the course of, you know, this long stretch of time that we've kind of exchanged positions in a way. And sometimes he and his husband come to see me on opening night, and sometimes I'm able to be there for his opening night. And it's
great.
Just, it's a lovely symbiotic relationship.
And nothing keeps you young and in perspective than when you were able to continue your craft. I mean, right now I'm in a point where I've got a 2-year-old son, I've got twins on the way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's wild. But when I can sit down, even if it's on the practice pad.
Yeah.
You know, and then talking to my teacher, he's doing the same thing. He's like, you know, his back's bothering him and X, Y, Z. And he's like, but I put an hour in on the pad today.
Yeah.
That there's something about that. And especially when you share that, you know, like with you and your teacher, me with mine, it's like, it's kind of what it's all about.
Yeah. It's your joy.
It's your joy.
It's your joy.
Yep.
There's nothing better than that.
Yeah. I want to get into some of the work that you started doing once you got, you know, into more of the professional work, started adding up. What was the first show that told you, like, oh, I'm doing this in terms of musical theater? Was there a show that you got on, you know, either an audition or once you got into the show that was like, okay, I'm doing this.
Okay, I know what I'm doing.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I think I've had multiple moments like that. Because,
still having that.
Yeah,
I feel that way.
You know, because we're always learning and we're always growing. And there's always a little bit of self-doubt that just lives with you. Mm-hmm. You know, as you get more experienced, of course, you gain confidence. You know, I don't get nervous for certain things like maybe I did when I was starting out. But there are still moments when I find myself on stage and I go, okay, I'm still doing this.
Yeah,
I don't know. I'm trying to think. You know, I remember there was a time when I was still kind of working my way up in my career, mm-hmm. and I was understudying someone. And I hadn't gone on for them before, maybe. I think this was the first time I was going on for them.
And what was the show?
This show was Legally Blonde on tour. And I was understudying a role called Paulette.
Mm-hmm.
She's played by Jennifer Coolidge in the film. It's just a funny, lovely, smart role. And the first time I went on, I want to say we were in Washington, D.C., maybe at the Kennedy Center. And there was another girl in the ensemble or who played another role who had been on for the role that she covered for like the week before me.
Okay.
And I went on at the last minute. For some reason, all of our creative team had been visiting at that time. So it was also like I'm thrown on and everybody's here to see it.
Yep.
And I was very, very different from the actress that I was understudying.
Okay.
So my character of Paulette had to, of course, be very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
We were very different people, which I love having that opportunity. So there was a lot of pressure. But I did the show. The show went great. I felt really good. It was fun. And I finished, and this other actress who had been on for the role, she understudied the week before, came over and she said, "It's a great reminder, isn't it?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And she goes, "We can do this. We got this."
There you
It's easy to, at the time, we were both in the ensemble, and my role in the ensemble in that show was, you know, and we made up a song called In the Dark on 14, because I was one of the shorter girls. So I was just always on the side, dancing in the dark. And so she was right. She said, it's a great reminder to go out there and go, oh, why was I worried?
Yep.
This is what I do.
Mm-hmm.
But it's easy to start to doubt yourself if you step away from it for very long.
Did it take you some time, you know, in those early years to put together the kind of work to where you were getting called as, you know, or is it more the audition circuit? What were the things that started more from the rhythm? Like you're getting enough work, enough sort of opportunities.
You know, I think the thing that really turns the corner is I do a lot of developmental work now in the musical theater world, which I love. And that kind of stuff most of the time really just comes from relationship building.
Yeah.
So I think it was when I first started doing that, I did a couple of readings that somebody had gotten my name for something. And then I started working with one of my dearest friends, Barbara Anselmi, as a composer. She was a musical director for many years. And she was a student with the BMI Lehman Engel Musical Theater Workshop, a very famous musical theater writer's workshop. And I don't remember if she was the first person to ask me to do something, but they'll ask singers to come in and perform their pieces for the lab and get feedback and rewrite them. It's a really incredible experience. And one writer, I don't remember who the first one was, asked me to come in and do their piece, and I did. And as a result, all these other writers started to say, "Oh, can I get your information? I'd love to have you sing on this. I'd love to have you record this demo." And it was an incredible experience for me to get to work with writers from the very start and help develop something. But also it put me in this world of people getting to know me, getting to know what I did, mm-hmm. getting to know how I was to work with, which hopefully, you know, I think I've got a good reputation in that sense. So then I started getting called, you know, these writers still now will call me as they're developing work for Broadway, or they'll give my name or a director who worked with me on something. And I think that's where you start to really realize, oh, people know me, people know what I do,
right?
People know what I do consistently. And so I get just called out of the blue. It's a wonderful feeling.
Yeah. Tell me about getting on Broadway. Was that, you know, and was Cats the first show?
No. Cats was my sixth Broadway show.
Wow, okay. So what was the first?
My first Broadway show was a show called a revival of 110 in the Shade.
Okay.
Which is almost from the golden era of, yeah. I would say, yeah, Tom Jones, Harvey mm-hmm. Schmidt, that era mm-hmm. of musical theater that was done with the Roundabout Theater Company, a very reputable theater company in New York. That produces a lot of great work, and it was a revival. Audra McDonald played the lead role. She was just a gem. Audra is a wonderful professional, fabulous person to work with. And it was exciting because, you know, at that point, I had been auditioning. I'd been in the world for some time, all right. kind of preparing me to get to that next place. Mm-hmm. And because I have kind of done a little bit of everything, I used to find myself a lot in audition rooms, and I'd get called in for one role. And I'd sing a little bit for that role or whatever. And then they'd say, oh, actually, can you look at this other role? A lot of times they didn't really know what to do with me.
Yeah.
Because I do a little bit of lots of different things.
Sure.
And this really worked in my favor for this particular show. There was a small ensemble of four men, four women. And they needed a swing, which is somebody, of course, who covers everybody, mm-hmm. to cover those ensemble women. And they ranged from, like, you know, the middle-aged minister's wife to, you know, the young flirty girl and the pregnant married lady, and kind of ran the gamut of age and type. And that was my first job,
wow.
to swing those characters, mm-hmm. which actually was kind of a great fit. It was an incredible experience because I had never swung before. And that is a whole other ball of wax.
Yeah, it would seem to be. Yeah,
yeah, it was an incredible yeah. learning experience. So that was my first Broadway show, and it was a limited run, so it wasn't something that was going to last forever, which right. was great for me career-wise. And even better, it's so funny, once you find yourself in that first, you get that first Broadway credit, then all of a sudden you find yourself in new audition rooms.
Okay, that's what I was wondering.
Yeah, it really is amazing how that works. So right away, I was getting called in for these other Broadway shows, and I was able to go, I mean, directly, without any days off, from closing that first Broadway show to my second Broadway show,
yeah.
which was as a replacement in The Drowsy Chaperone on Broadway, where I was covering the two female ensemble roles. I was an offstage cover, but I also covered the two female leads, The Drowsy Chaperone
wow.
and Janet, who were, at the time that I was hired, being played by two Tony Award winners, Beth Level and Sutton Foster.
Now, would that have been called a swing role as well in that next
show,
sort of?
I think it was called an offstage swing or partial okay. swing or
yeah.
something like
okay.
that, because I sang backstage every night, and I was covering two principal roles, but also covering these two ensemble roles. So it was kind of an odd, not a track that you normally see
gotcha.
In musical theater, but I think it was called a partial swing,
okay.
I believe was the title. But it was cool because it was definitely a step forward for me career-wise.
Certainly.
To be covering these incredible talents. And it was a whole new world. Yeah, it was very exciting.
That's great. Some of the roles that you've played, you know, are incredible. And roles like, I know that Rachel Asbell, our education program manager who you met
mm-hmm.
and went to schools with, which we'll talk later about, she saw you as Elphaba.
Oh, that's right. She said that in Cincinnati.
And she didn't put two and two together until she met you and realized, oh, you were Elphaba at an age where she was very formative for her because
yeah.
musical theater was a real on-road entryway into singing for her. Is there a role or are there roles that even now you look back on and go like, ooh, I got to do that. Like I got to play that role or you know.
Absolutely. Just, yeah. I mean, the biggest one that comes to mind is probably the role that I'm most known for among musical theater fans, and that's Grisabella in Cats.
Sure.
Because I do this one-woman show where I talk about my introduction to Cats, which was essentially my introduction to musical theater. When I was about 12, I happened upon, I just luckily wound up in my hand with a two-cassette original Broadway cast recording of Cats. Mm. And I had never heard anything like that. I really hadn't heard a lot of musical theater. And what I had heard at that time was like, you know, I'd seen Shirley Temple movies on
right.
TV, Stage Door, like all these old-fashioned, I was listening mm-hmm. to Lena Horne and mm-hmm. fun stuff like that. This was a whole new world. And so I would dance around in my bedroom and sing along. And so I think when I landed in Cats, and of course as Grisabella, who's Grisabella sings Memory, one of the most iconic songs
right.
of all time. And her journey throughout Cats is kind of is the story you follow the most, which I'm sure a lot of people who are familiar with Cats would be like, there's a story?
Yeah.
But, you know, you see her kind of in all these individual moments throughout the piece where you kind of get to know that, you know, the basic gist of who she is and what she's dealing with. She's been basically excommunicated from this tribe of cats and is lonely and is on the outskirts of the group. And Memory is her, what I call, you know, this is her final, her last cry for help.
Mm.
And she's, of course, rewarded with traveling to the Heaviside Layer. It's a whole thing.
Yeah,
Cats is a whole
it's
thing.
It's deep. It's deep.
It's deep. And yet it's also confusing to most people, but it's beautiful, and the score is unlike anything else. And I think that was really, as cliche as it says, as it is to say, it was a full circle moment for me to go from being this 12-year-old dreaming of what this kind of thing would look like on a stage to actually walking out on stage in the costume and feeling the entire audience hold their breath while you sing this incredible piece of music for them.
Wow. It's the kind of thing that I'm sure in a career, you know, you're calling your parents or you're talking, you know, you're trying to get tickets for your friends, and you just and it's funny now because there are a few vocalists who I sort of follow on Instagram who are understudies or on, you know, on Broadway or whatever, and there is a following not only of the character on the but who's playing the role. Did you feel like when you were playing that role or Elphaba, which was a little bit even more current, mm-hmm. that people started to know you, Mamie Paris, you know, because you played that role?
Absolutely. I've been, you know, musical theater fans are unlike any other fans
right.
in the dedication and the love that so many people put into their fandom. And it's really glorious. I'm so appreciative for the fans. Wicked has some incredible fans out there. And people really do follow you through your career. And it's lovely to see people that I've met once or twice, or sometimes I've never met in person, who are, you know, so excited for you and so supportive of you and can't wait to see what the next thing is you do.
Right.
It's very, very exciting. And I remember feeling terrible because Wicked has such an incredible fan base. There were some times I couldn't meet everybody at the stage door.
Right. That's
kind of
what I was wondering.
It just was not possible.
Yeah,
like in L.A., oh my goodness, we'd have to, and I'd have to limit myself, which, you know, I'm sure sometimes wasn't the most fun for fans, but I didn't have time to stand and chat or sign everything because I wanted to get to as many people as possible.
Yeah.
Out of fairness, everybody came and stayed. And
you got to get that green off at some point in time, right?
Yeah, that takes a little while. It takes a little while. So, but it is really great to have those fans. And it's so rewarding to me as well to see several fans that, you know, I might have called super fans or fan friends who were fans who followed me in the business as well as other performers, and see them grow up and go to college if they were young when they started this and go into careers in the theater.
Yeah.
Because I'm a big advocate for the idea that you might fall in love with singing, you might fall in love with acting, you might want to be on stage, but at the end of the day, you might decide that there's a place for you in this industry that you didn't even know about
right.
at 12.
Right.
You know, that you might wind up in administration or development mm-hmm. or education, and that's stuff that we really need, that this business absolutely needs.
I say that all the time about the nonprofit arena.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
I was fortunate that my drum teacher in college was the executive director here at JAG for a period of time. So I was learning how to play the drums, but I was catching, you know, things that I didn't quite understand then, but then would piece together about you know, grants and education programs and how a nonprofit can serve with a mission and mm-hmm. get public funding. And I think as we've seen players, sound engineers, music business people, all of our interns come in and there's a certain degree of like, oh, this is like a whole other
element
of the
here.
Industry, which I'm sure you've encountered too, where you can sort of, you know, and you do voiceover work now. And I think that element, especially for young people in 2023,
sure.
trying to piece together, what's my career going to look like? This is what I love, singing or whatever it is, but I have to make my rent, you know, I, you know, as we all do. That's a perfect segue to education. It strikes me just in the brief time we've spoken that teaching and sharing your craft is important to you.
I really enjoy it.
Talk about what you're doing these days with education.
You know, I spend a lot of time. I coach on the side, young, you know, and peers, musical theater artists, acting students, and then a lot of students coming straight out of college or going into college, that kind of thing, which I really, really enjoy. Mm-hmm. I get to travel places and do master classes with high schools and colleges. I've worked with some wonderful students that way. And then I love when I get opportunities like here in Columbus. You know, when they called me about coming and doing the show here, they also said, listen, we have this great education outreach program. Would you be available and interested to come and maybe meet with students? And I said, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that I'm always so incredibly impressed with the faculty, the people who can do it all the time.
Right.
Because I find it so rewarding to work with these students and so fascinating and interesting. Welcome to the day. But also, I'm exhausted.
Right.
You do a couple of those in a row and I go home and go, our educators pay them more.
I know.
And it's not because kids are difficult or no, it's none of that. It's just the amount of energy and excitement that is there to learn and grow in the arts is so exciting. And I probably expend way more energy than I should when I do it as well.
I
just get so excited about working with these students. Mm-hmm. And these students are so ready to learn and ready to grow. It's so impressive, and it really fulfills me as an artist. I wind up coming back and being able to walk into the Southern Theater to do this show freshly inspired and ready to try new things I learn from these students. Yeah. So it's an exciting thing. I really enjoy it.
And Rachel had mentioned that at the second school that we went to, that you and she went to, Olentangy Orange, there was a bit of sort of like fandom, like, oh my God, you played these roles.
Yeah.
That's, I think, you know, on the surface level, that's fun. You know, kids get to meet and see people that they may have followed, you know, in the arts or in the thing that they love. But I think it's also important because they need to know that people do this, real people in the flesh do this for a living, especially in the age of, and I sound so old to say this, but so much of it is on their screen.
Yes.
And lives in a certain degree of like autonomy, like anonymity.
Yes.
Where like, you're a person, but you're only a person on my screen. I think more than ever to see a person who did the thing that I love in the flesh, interacting with me, I think can go a really long way.
I think it really can. And that's one of the other reasons I love doing it. You know, yesterday at Olentangy Orange, really great students, so ready to work. To see them grow, it was great. Mm. And they asked a lot of great questions.
Yeah.
And one question that I particularly loved, that I loved that this student was not afraid to ask, they said, how much do you make?
Wow.
And I really appreciate that
because
here's the thing. Like you said, I want them to know that you can have a fulfilling, sometimes lucrative career in the arts without being Nicole Kidman,
sure.
without being a rock star, without being Taylor Swift. Mm-hmm. You know, that there are careers on and off stage, on and off screen, you know, on and off the album that are very fulfilling and very lucrative and allow you to choose to have a family if you want one, allow you to choose to own a home or homes or, you know, that it's a real job. And so I really appreciate it. And I answered it honestly. And I said, there are gigs when you make this much and there are gigs when you make this much. And the real trick is learning how to manage going between all of them, going among all of them and making the money you need to make. But I just love that. I love that they're thinking about that.
Yeah. And I think it's even more important now, as you know, college is so expensive, you know, the barrier to entry can often be, you know, really high.
Oh, incredibly prohibitive.
And the pressure and the competitiveness of programs. So I think that's as early as you can be thinking about that is probably it's a good thing.
And thinking about it realistically.
Right.
You know, that there is a ceiling, sure, a very high ceiling, but there's also a floor.
Right.
And, you know, it's something. Everybody comes out of college these days with debt. Mm-hmm. It's terrible, but it's true. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for artists where your income isn't as consistent, you just have to know that might be with you for a while.
Yeah.
And you got to figure it out.
Well, there's so much that I want to continue to talk about, but you have to perform this evening as we record this. It's Friday afternoon, and you still have 3 shows left with us.
Yes, I'm so excited.
Which is amazing. Let's sort of close just talking about that. It's the holiday season.
It is the holiday season.
Yeah, that's right. And so I'm sure for your entire professional, and maybe even before that, life, this is a season of work for someone like you.
I love it.
So you know, holiday tunes, you like them?
I love holiday tunes. And I love all holiday tunes.
Okay.
Like, give me everything. Secular, non-secular,
yeah, right.
You know, songs from other cultures, songs about things that aren't Christmas, Hanukkah songs, Kwanzaa songs, bring them on.
Yeah.
Because there's something about a carol. There's something about this time of year where there's community, everybody comes together, you eat the heavy food, you know, you drink the warm drinks. It's so wonderful and festive, and I think no matter how you grew up and what culture you come from, I think this time of year can be a time of real community and family. And so I love doing these kinds of holiday shows. I love singing the songs. And I really love the audiences that come out for mm-hmm. holiday shows. You know, a lot of times, here at least, I feel like you have very wonderful, consistent audiences that come and support the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, which is great. Mm-hmm. A lot of times across the board when I sing these holiday concerts with symphony orchestras, this might be the only time of year that some of these ticket holders come out and listen to the orchestra in their city. And I feel so grateful to be a part of that. And they'll bring the family. You'll see people come in matching sweaters mm-hmm. and bring the kids. And a lot of times Santa is there. I don't want to give anything away, but sometimes Santa's there. Makes an appearance, even here in Columbus.
Yeah.
And you might be able to get a photo with him. Yeah. So that's really special. Yeah. But I grew up singing all of these songs. Like I said, my family always sang, harmonized in the car, and of course around the holidays. We never stopped singing.
And I was going to mention that. I was able to listen to you on Thursday evening. Sounded wonderful.
Thank you.
And one of the things I noticed is you're so comfortable in front of a big band. And I'm not surprised by that on your behalf, but not all musical theater folks carry themselves with that level of calm when there's chances that things can go differently than expected.
Oh, that's
jazz and the spontaneity. You know, every now and then you get someone that's like, wait, I wasn't ready to hear that.
Yeah,
Bobby Floyd,
true.
Why'd you play that instead of this? You came out there from the first note and you took command of the band, which not every singer, particularly with a theater background, can do. Is that because you have experience in other things than musical theater? Does that take you back to, like, you know, combo gigs or just gigs?
Absolutely. Yeah. It really does. Absolutely. Yeah. I think part of that was coming up in Kansas City and singing at the Godfather's Pizza with my 4 other band kids from school. You know, I did that stuff so young. But I also think it's, you know, we're all different people and we all have our different strengths.
Exactly.
And, you know, doing these concerts, sometimes I'll have other musical theater performers, other performers I work with, and they say, oh my goodness, that sounds so fun. I would love to do that. And I warn them and I say, this is not for everybody.
Yeah.
You really do have to be comfortable expecting anything, especially singing with a big band like this, which I love. And that's one of the things I love about it, mm-hmm. is if we want to take that repeat one more time, if Bobby Floyd is popping off on the organ, don't come back to me.
Yeah,
I want
to
hear more
yet.
Of that. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I love, you know, Byron and I work so well together, and I trust Byron inherently, and I feel like he trusts me. So there's that feeling that we're all kind of on this ride together and we just go with it. And it gives you such wonderful freedom as a vocalist, as a performer, to not worry about things. Mm-hmm. I'm not worried about going up on a lyric. We will scat it out.
Right.
We will take that repeat. We will go again, because we're just all here to have a good time, especially singing these holiday tunes.
Right.
These are songs everybody knows and loves some version of it. So let's have a little fun in the process. I think it's just a good time.
Yeah.
And I trust these musicians, and that's everything.
Absolutely. Well, that's the perfect way to close this. And I encourage our listeners that catch this podcast as it comes out to jump on JAG TV, Jazz Arts Group's YouTube platform and website, to see some of the recordings. If those that aren't going to be here, there's still some holiday season left as this podcast rolls out.
There's so much holiday season.
You can
left.
Go to JAG.TV, you can get on our YouTube page, and you can hear clips and for a period the full concert.
Put it on while you decorate the tree.
That's right. There's no better time to put some music on in the background.
Absolutely.
Than now. But Mamie, it's been such a pleasure. I feel like already you're a part of the JAG family.
Oh, I love it. Yay.
Not only will musical theater folks follow you, but the JAG folks will follow you.
I hope so. I've loved being here.
And I really want to thank you sincerely for your work with our students. Rachel was so thrilled that you were able to impact them as you did, and just can't wait to see what's next for you.
Oh, thank you. It is my pleasure. I enjoy being here. I've loved working with these students. I've loved working with these musicians. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Home for the Holidays will be available to watch at JAG.TV on December 15th. That's JAG.TV. The Jazz Scene is presented by Jazz Arts Group of Columbus, America's oldest nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the art of jazz. Our theme music is titled 3-4 Times by Michael Cox. This episode was hosted by Zach Compston and produced and engineered by Mercedes Aviles. Subscribe to The Jazz Scene wherever you get your podcasts.